Okay.
Just for the record, this is Claire Kilman with Carbondale Spring.
This is Bo Henson, that's B-E-A-U, last name H-E-N-S-O-N, also Carbondale Spring.
You guys are media pros. I was just to ask you that.
We know how this goes.
Yeah. Okay, cool. First of all, what were you just about to tell me?
So I was telling you that, as I had previously said today, we are reluctant to incorporate the movement itself. We produce several arms, several facets of this, and certain things come out of this project that necessitate incorporation, right? But it's usually the facet itself that gets incorporated. Like, we've established a revolving loan fund that will be incorporated. We have a chamber of cooperation that will be incorporated. We have a system of food farms that will be connected through, like, existing community gardens and have, like, a teaching facility. All of that will be incorporated. Like, there'll be several worker co-ops that spin out of all of these projects, right? The care worker program will itself be incorporated. But Carbondale Spring as a movement is sort of amorphous and above that. Right? So there's really no reason to incorporate this movement specifically, because once you attach an identity to something, right, if there's something sort of galvanized, stereotypes can crop up about that. If you crystallize the form of a thing, it's like with anarchy or anarchism as it currently exists, there's like the masked up, like bandanaed, red, black, like spray painting A's. And that's like a stereotype, right? And that can be commodified. It can be co-opted by capital and bought and sold. And it kind of nullifies or lessens the revolutionary context. One, because it can be parodied, right? But then two, because it becomes like another market that opens up. And in not allowing ourselves to incorporate, we're trying to like mitigate that to the best of our ability.
Yeah. You know, what we're really talking about here is municipalism, and to go off this point that Claire's making, it's the combination of reconfiguring the structure of local government with social movement. So local governance, whatever that means to you, is going to take form, whether it's in some type of incorporation or some type of social contract, but the social movement absolutely cannot have constraints. We have to have the ability to fight back in any way we see fit. So Carbondale Spring itself will always remain a social movement, will always remain ad hoc, and it's a very important distinction to make.
Amazing. That leads me so many more questions. How does that play out practically when it's a social movement? Does it mean that it can shrink and grow dynamically? And yeah,
The wonderful thing about non-incorporating is that if we butt up against the powers that be and they decide that they would like to take legal action, right, or they would like to harass, right, or they would like to vilify, there's not one face. There's not a list of names you can get a hold of. There's not like this entity called Carbondale Spring that you can sue, that you can legislate against. There is no legal form for this. And it actually protects us in a lot of ways. It's dual faceted, right? So like a lot of times in a revolutionary context, people will want to like operate with a certain level of anonymity, right? And we're riding a fine line between that and publicity, because we have a sort of public presence and a public face. We've got social media, we've got a website, people can like engage with us and like identify with us, but like there can be really no like punitive action or legal action taken against us because of our unwillingness to incorporate, one, but then the sort of buffer that like a public face provides us. For instance, we are trying to cut/by half a police budget. And it's like the top line item on a budget. It's a purely neoliberal argument, but like obviously that could anger police. And police have been known to harass various social movements and groups that are seeking justice or challenging power throughout, you know, millennia. And in this instance, I think that our like public face, our failure to incorporate, etc., like all of that sort of protects us in ways that anonymity never could.
So this is lessons learned from anarchistic horizontal organizing throughout the years, correct? We have a mantra here. We say build and fight. And when we look back at the history of these kind of movements, we see the 1990s and the Battle of Seattle as the fight. We see the Occupy movement as the reimagining of the world. We see Carbondale Spring inside municipalism as like the build phase of what we're trying to do. So it becomes very important that people understand that this is like a different type of mask. It's actually a sense of security as you project forward in these type of ways, trying to create something brand new.
You were saying that there was 2024 was a kind of marker year for you by which you wanted to achieve some kind of regional autonomy. Can you just tell me a little bit more about that and what you envisage?
So,
and how that fits the eclipse.
So it's an interesting, a way of being, right? So like there's this cosmological event happening, right? And Carbondale, but Southern Illinois as a region, sits on the line of totality, right? For this eclipse, for both of them, for both of those eclipses. And there's this sort of window period that we're kind of marking out between and assigning a sort of function to these two like major cosmological events, right? It's like a sort of hearkening back to, so like in indigenous culture, there's like a sort of implicit understanding of a symbiotic relationship between all things, right? And the way in which modern society, especially Western society, has constructed itself, it's often forgotten that principle, right? Like we see ourselves as fundamentally removed, as set apart. And like we build and construct our world in that way, literally digging up in a lot of instances like corpse material from the ground and integrating into our life, like plastics, like fossil fuels, etc. And there's this entire like reimagining of the way in which we're relating to our environment, to all things, to this process called revolution, even like to the collectivization of our bodies and like the energizing of them in that way, like. We're like giving ourselves a sort of deadline, a window right. by which to accomplish our aims.
It's also a pushback on the ability for capitalism to commodify absolutely anything. So where we live has been just absolutely hollowed out. It is just an extraction zone of natural resources, of human talent, everything. And these two eclipses have been considered like an opportunity to bring in tourism dollars in order to stem that like that tide. We find this as an attempt to like reclaim those moments inside of the spirit in which we're working.
Yeah.
And just so that I'm clear, like by 2024, what are those aims? What does it look like? What are the
Building the future, or so how do I say this?
If they can be articulated in precise ways, I don't think they may not be.
So, it's more like Carbondale Springs' aim is to work into the imagination or bring to the fore, right, the ability for the public to expand its own imagination of what its reality could be. So, we're working within this imaginary realm of like, alternate realities or realities that could possibly exist. We're expanding the realm of possibilities such that like there are futures that people could superimpose out onto their realities. Where like it's the future that they want to live in. It's a future worth living in, right? Like how often can we look around our current society and say that about the world? Like I see a future worth living in here as this exists now. Oftentimes I would say no. Like that's a hard sell, but if I can like at least lay the groundwork for someone to like see a future, right, where there's the possibility for them to even like imagine a future worth living in within that, right? If they could achieve that, imagine what else they could achieve. If they could achieve like the very realistic goals we feel like we're setting, right, where it's just like a transference of dollars and a reprioritization of public funds. If like they can achieve at least that, imagine what else they could achieve. Like, that's the realm in which we're working in as far as it relates to public imagination. Yeah.
And we have our own platform, like we put this out as Carmel Spring, but we can't tell the future. Furthermore, like we refuse to speak for other people and how their future may be. So we take two different types of routes. One based on constituent power, where people are considering organizing in this certain form around their own needs, thereby just creating like 1,000 fingers inside of our community. But the hope is when these needs come across like a agreed upon moment, that those fingers will like collapse into like this fist of constituent power that then would be able to like influence or potentially completely invert the power structure of our city.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're utilizing dual power theory to sort of achieve what Bo is talking about. So like, you can't just sort of have this sort of like idealistic notion of things, right? Like you have to build the material conditions upon which, like laying the foundation upon which power can be challenged. And like, you have to have a sort of a relationship to power where like you're on equal footing when you make that challenge, right? Like we can only challenge what we can combat. And like if we're much, much smaller, much more reduced in our own capacities, like we can't combat power at the level at which it's being done, which it's being administered, at the level at which it's being currently enforced. Like upon pain of death sometimes in the United States, where like our police forces, if you don't have enough money or you're the wrong color, you'll be like obliterated. And it's just like a part of the system, or you'll be incorporated into what are basically modern day slave catchment systems. And like that's just the United States.
Yeah, so dual power requires the creation of alternative institutions outside of like the state itself. And you can see this inside the platform of the Carbondale Spring. Not only is it about like reducing the power of the armed section of the state, but we look at things like care workers, a group of trained people that will be able to create a buffer between the populace and the police itself, food autonomy, the ability to feed ourselves, worker co-ops, the ability to combat income inequality and just create a place where people can practice the civic necessities in order to get to a thing that like municipalism would be, but also it's about the environment. And we look at renewable energy, but we also look at the earth as like a third and serious political actor outside of the economy of our current political system.
So like the way in which politics has traditionally been had has incorporated like a public and an electorate, or I mean at least in the modern sense, but that has been like the nobility before, right? That has been like a feudalism before that. Like there are all these different methods in which like power has organized itself in this sort of dualistic mode of like almost master slave, right? Almost like a Hegelian dialectic sort of way. But like these have failed or fail to in the current context incorporate the third political actor, that being the planet.
Dying. Right?
Literally responding to, on a global scale, on a planetary scale, our involvement in it. And like, we are Earth. We are of Earth. We are fundamentally Earth. And like, every action that we take, again, back to the symbiotic relationship between all things, has an effect on Earth. When you change something, you change Earth. And like, we, in forgetting that, the planet is now responding to our lack of acknowledgement of its existence. And like, I think that in whatever we do, we intend to incorporate at least the planet as a factor, as like a political actor, so to speak, between like the what is generally a two-way dialogue. Now the geometry of that dialogue has changed to three.
So what's really interesting about this is when you like insert the Earth as a third political actor, it actually takes that economy and like, if you can visualize it, turns it into a triangle and then like sets it like on its side, right? And what that opens up is like new patterns of communication where like a city can be reimagined around like a design of need and space instead of ideology. And that just opens up like avenues of communication between people who by design are supposed to not talk to each other. We're talking the poor and affluent. We're talking black and white. We're talking queer and straight. We're talking commerce versus community. Right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask for something about, which is an amazing way of saying something that I've sort of thought about but never heard articulated, which is giving people the permission to want something that they don't know that they have the permission to want. And obviously that you encountering that on like a methodological level when you're interviewing people, you're like realizing that they're not telling you what they need, which isn't, they're not even obscuring anything, they just don't have even, they can't even access those needs because they don't know that they have permission for them. But do you have any anecdotes or examples of where you've kind of both, just everyone's discovered what those needs are, like having, getting permission to want something.
Sometimes, so like, again, when you're working in the imagination, right? Like, we're talking about like distilling a sort of radical vision out there in this. And like when we presented our like talk about the truth, because that's really what it's, when you pinpoint like truths, underlying truths, truths that don't get discussed, right? When you talk about like the insidious nature of the police, all of a sudden, if you give a talk like that in, say, the northeast side of Carbondale, which is wholly black, right? It's wholly poor. It's traditionally the poor black neighborhood. And oftentimes those things in American society go hand in hand. Like, when you give that talk about the police there, you start uncovering all of these layers, these stories, right, of, like, people feeling like it's okay to speak their truth, right? Like, when we talk about, you know, the police is a continuation of slave catchment, of co-opting whiteness, and then turning that into the first police force, or the first policing apparatus in the United States. And then, like, the kind of sloughing off of the burden of policing onto municipalities instead of it being on, like, business owners or corporations. Like, it used to be a private entity, and then they got the public to pay for police to come in and, like, beat them, right? And when you tell that truth and when you speak to that history to, like people, right, all of a sudden they start opening up. Really, it's about more, like, one, acknowledging truth, but then, two, making friends. Doing the networking, the sincere legwork of, like, listening and understanding people, and, like, getting to know them, not just trying to be, like, white people coming in with a handout, right? White people coming in with presupposed solutions, right? Like, you really have to get to know these people as friends. I mean, I have, like, sort of a saying, like, we're friends before we're coworkers. Like, I would not want to engage on anyone without that sort of relationship already being built, because I want them to be honest with me. I don't want them to see me as a stranger, like a white stranger coming in to try to solve all their problems from, like, someplace on high. Right? Like, I want them to see me like as someone who's there to, like, stand shoulder to shoulder with them and, like, engage in the same struggle with them. And, like, through that, we just collectively share truth.
Yeah, I think authentic relationships as the first step is extraordinarily important. When Carmel Spring was launched, it was February of 2019. We have gone through 4 or 5 years of organizing, but the year before was three distinct fights of, like, defense. One was against a cop academy on our local university. The second you heard about today was what we call the Brightfields fight, where two international corporations wanted to build on a piece of contaminated land that had poisoned over 1,000 black people in our city. The third was Trump actually came to our little town of 20,000. Through those fights, we had organized very specifically, like, around class, but at the intersection of identities, right? Breaking down those barriers. And through that together, we found the power of no. But going back through the build, we decided we actually wanted to go on, like, a spring offensive, which is what the Carmel Spring is. So that's also just a change in mindset, that you actually have more power than just saying no to these actors who have dominated our lives for thousands of years at this point, and that you can project something else.
So this is an important point, right? Like, in that traditional political dialogue where there's only two parties, it's like we presuppose or we assume that individuals we elect or individuals who hold money, power, right, visible power, have all of the power. But, like, we challenge that assumption, that notion. Like, every individual has an innate power. Like, they have their own capacities. They have this internal power that just doesn't go away, it doesn't dissipate, and, you know, someone can't take it from you, right? Like, and it's about what you use that power for. Like, even though you may feel disempowered by current ways of relating to one another along hierarchical structures of relationships to power, that doesn't negate the fact that you actually have all of the power within yourself to affect change.
So this is a place where I like to bring out, like, Foucault's boomerang, right? We live in the, like, the seat of imperialism, and imperialists America has learned some distinct lessons in like Iraq and Afghanistan. These includes like urban warfare, counterinsurgency, extreme militarism that is now like coming home in the form of like the militarized police system that we have. Extreme extraction from these rural areas and some like urban areas. These are places we call the hinterlands.
Open your panopticons.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right? So like we are now being colonized ourselves, and like I like to make this joke, this is like new for white people. So like when we go and we organize in places that have like the Northeast side, which is predominantly black and has been historically segregated, we're actually asking for help, which is like fundamentally unfair to ask of these people. But in exchange, what we're doing is we're offering all the skills and all the positions that we've gained through white privilege. And what we're attempting to do is weaponize white privilege in an attempt to just facilitate the needs of like the people that are in any given locality.
Yeah.
And it's an important place to be, and it all starts with authentic relationships.
Yeah. I'm so interested in what your strategy around using political theory and critical theory in practical ways that open up lines of communication with people that then actually builds more authentic relationships that then is the foundation in which to then start talking about the needs and so on, because I suppose a lot of the flack that critical theory comes under is that in fact it's producing closures all the time. It actually isn't doing the emancipatory work that it was designed to do, because it's become ivory tower stuff that never really translates into practical action.
Yeah, get over yourself.
So this is like, yeah, this is what I'm kind of really interested to dig into, especially with this whole project of the Anthropocene, which is itself a very contested term, because again, it's producing closures. It's like, it's a done deal, everything's over, and it's like, well, A, it's the world's already ended, like with colonialism, settler colonialism, this is a white term, but also it doesn't necessarily give space to conversations that more are affirmative and practical and strategic, like are already carving out spaces of new worlds. So yeah, I just wondered if you guys thought about that very much, or if we've just come to it intuitively.
So this is an interesting point to make, right? Like some of us are tapping into this. It's like, how do you quantify or qualify either? Like the time in which like someone's like life, right, has become a part of Carbondale Spring, right? It's like there are all of these long histories that we've all got within ourselves, within our relationships to the world, the systems that be here, that we're bringing to the table when we engage in this, right? And like for some of us, this is our life project. This is something that we intend to work on until we die, whenever that is. I'm like, we're committed to that. For some of us, this is like a realization that we've had as we've like dropped out of the current system, as we've come to these horrific realizations through our own privilege, through our own like study, right, of like how our actions and the actions of like the systems that were birthed from our ancestors have affected people. Some of this is like old hat to some people, where it's like quick, like if you're black in America, you just know.
Just get it.
Pretty much all of us, right? Like you don't have to have like the sort of history lesson. Like for me as a queer person, right? Like I understand that my historical relationship to the police is very fraught. But as a white person, it's like I understand that like I get a lot of privilege as it relates to the police, as opposed to like say a black trans woman. And all of that kind of culminates in this sort of like open discussion about like what we all have to contribute, I guess. Would you repeat your question or like or continue?
Yeah, sure. One, I just made the quip, like, get over it, right?
Yeah.
So it really, like, begs this question of, like, what is your role in this moment? For a lot of us, especially ones who come from privileged backgrounds, it is about defecting. It is about dropping out. It is about, like, giving everything you have away until basically you're on, what? It's like this level that is understood by the most people.
It's honestly like taking a vow of poverty, right? So like in a lot of ways, it's very similar to like monastic life in that way. We're like, we're engaged in struggle. And like, in order for people to trust us, in order for people to see that we're serious about this, we have to like give up whatever privilege we've got. And still using the assets that we get from that, still using the sort of like language that I can impart to anyone, right? Like, I'm generally in rooms with people who are twice my age because I'm a reasonably educated white woman, right? But the life that I live is that such, like, I'm on a block and working out of a block that is populated largely by homeless black people, right? And in both situations, I am almost equally respected, equally socialized with, right? Because I've given up a lot in order to do the work that I'm doing. And I wouldn't have it any other way because I've come to those, like, truths. I've met with the truth. And the truth has shown me that, like, what the people like me did previously, in previous generations, what that all culminated in, how they've, like, harmed other people, the planet, etc., how they've forgotten that symbiotic relationship has resulted in literally, like, the ecological crises that are going to kill our species. Like, it's gonna choke out life. The capacity for us to understand the universe, being a part of the universe, right? Like, where the universe is best shot at understanding itself, where our planet's observational capacities, etc. Like, we have a high level of being able to cognate, cognition, right? Like, as cognitive beings, like, we're smart. Like, all of that. Like, what do we do with that?
I would like to go back to queerness.
Yeah.
Right? We like to say that the first death of the revolution is the revolution itself. So we actually take queer theory and like attack critical theory and anarchism and far left thought with it, right? That like power is always moving and the juxtaposition of your position to that power is also always moving.
It's a dualistic moving goalpost. Power will always move that goalpost on you. You have to be able to also move your goalpost as far as you challenging power. And like, you can't allow yourself to sort of crystallize the form at which you're going after yep. power. You have to like shift it and move it. And every time power gives you a justification, you have to figure out a way to attack that justification. Every time power makes an ask of you, you have to make an ask of power.
And we do this internally as well.
Yep.
Like when any time a hierarchy like naturally emerges inside of our organizing, we take the time to like fight each other and like destroy that hierarchy itself. Right?
If you want to start throwing punches, you have to be willing to take a punch.
Yeah.
And like that's just part of it. And like we try to institute the Rajavan practice of techmeal. Right, which is like an internal critique, where we all sit down and we allow for each other to be critique, and sometimes that is fraught, right? Like it is hard to accept and to give critique. Oftentimes people feel like it's either unwarranted or they're unwilling to let it flow through them. And like I have been on the receiving end of many a critique, and I've also been in the position of giving many a critique. But like that is an important phase in our own like revolutionary process, and it's something that we continually have to go back to.
Have you guys been out to Syria?
No.
No,
I have not.
You can't visit Kurdish communities. But so, couple of questions. Mm-hmm. A, how did you all find each other? And B, it seems that this Rajavian experience is informing heavily your strategic work. How did that come about?
So, again, some of us are coming from like the Occupy movement. Right? Some of us are coming from the moment, like myself particularly, I come from like a queer activist background, right? Where I've been engaging along the axis of queer oppression for a long time against power. And like at a certain point, it became like this convergence when Trump came, right? And at the time that Trump came to this area, it was in October of 2018. And during that process of him coming here, it was in the midst of the administration rolling out all of these like anti-trans things. And that, for me, was important to speak about. And when I spoke out about that, and when I occupied the steps of City Hall here to declare him unwelcome in our town, I was connected to the energy of all of these really wonderful people who were, again, coming at it from all of these, like, defector stances. Like, I don't want to speak for Bo, but I know that Bo came to a bunch of realizations about, like, his his previous capacities, his previous involvements, and then dropped out. If you want to speak about that.
So I just come from an economic background. Very shortly, through many years, I was involved in activities that was basically destroying the earth. And going back to a former point, like, I had to give that up after a lifetime of climbing the corporate ladder. But to go to your question about Rojava specifically, mm-hmm. is like, when we talk to black people in our town, there's this like distrust, right? That in no way can a white construct understand like the needs and desires of like the black man or the black person. Yeah. So we look all types of places, right? So you can talk about democratic confederalism coming out of Rojava. We look at the Zapatistas. This intersects quite nicely with social ecology. Murray Bookchin is about as white as it gets, right? Murray Bookchin's not particularly an anarchist, and like we like to joke, we're really bad anarchists.
Oh, if I'm an anarchist, I am a shit anarchist, let me tell you.
So there's just like this willingness to like take whatever works and apply it to a hyper-local context. If there's anything generalizable about Carmel Spring, it's exactly that. It's just like whatever works in your place.
In this instance, it's like we're an extraction zone, right? Like we've been historically extracted upon. We live in an extraction economy. One minute. Okay. An extraction economy in which like black bodies were literally trucked in here in order to be poisoned. That's what the Brightfields people and the Coppers plant people were coming here to talk about. Right? And like... this whole, what did you just say, Bo? I lost my thought because of that.
Beer number three.
You're like, if there's anything generalizable about the carbon.
Oh, yeah, so we have a hyper-local context that potentially the only generalizable thing about this.
Mm-hmm. What did you say before that?
Don't remember.
Shit, sorry.
You were talking about anarchists, and you said, if I'm an anarchist, you're a really bad one.
Oh, yeah.
You were talking about different groups that you were inspired by.
I lost my train of thought.
Oh, no.
What's next?
It'll come back. Yeah. I mean, I thought half an hour is
All right, wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, this is great. If there's anything else, then I can always get in touch and have a conversation.
Of course.
Right. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you. I love having those type of discussions.
Yeah. It's nice for us to get that out there, right? Like, sometimes we have to hide that.
Which?
All of it.
So sometimes our public face has to be legitimized, right? Like we have to legitimize our front face to the extent that we look a lot like power. We look a lot like incorporation. We look a lot like a fully branded entity ready for consumption. And like oftentimes the ideological core of what we're doing or like the heart and soul of like what we're trying to accomplish philosophically is quite different. And sometimes it's nice to just talk about the philosophy of the thing.
Yeah. Walking that like tight rope is it's a stressor for sure.
Even internally,
you get into the ideas of like co-optation and like just reinforcing the dominant capitalist system. We don't know if it's gonna work.
Oh, but it's an experiment. It's an experiment.
Yeah.
Small things experimental. You make yourself mistakes as well.
Oh yeah.
I would rather. Again, and I've said this to you once already, I would rather go to bed knowing that I tried my hardest. I couldn't sleep otherwise. Like, knowing what I know about the way in which our planet is, like, dying. Knowing what I know about environmental injustice and environmental racism in the United States. Knowing what I know about the caste system that presents itself here. Knowing what I know about the historical legacies of oppression that, like, multiple different groups along, like, all sorts of axes, like, experience. Like, I can't not do everything I possibly can and weaponize everything I possibly can. This is what I was going to say earlier. It's like, oftentimes Bo likes to say, if you're in a street fight and like you don't have anything on you, you pick up whatever you can. You pick up rocks, you pick up sticks, and you throw them or you use them. And like, oftentimes what we're doing is we're just taking whatever someone has to contribute to this and like weaponizing it and throwing it as hard as we can at the current system.
Yeah, so we've been told this is like the hacker mind approach to like revolution, and it is quite inspiring because like it looks normal to people, but it also looks completely new to people.
Yeah.
And like some of like some of the responses we get to from the power structure, your ordinary conservative, like your centrist Democrat, is, okay, I agree on a few things, I'm starting to understand this, I need to go back and turn on like my 1960s mind, right? So this idea of experimentation or that something new is being birthed actually spreads throughout the entire town.
Yep.
Actually, I do have another question. Mm-hmm. Is I'm interested in this relationship between you guys, Carbon Dust, an unincorporated collection of individuals. You have clearly spent a lot. You guys just meld together your brains for like considerations of each other. Like they're so in sync, very politically and theoretically informed. But right? That's so much thinking about this. And then the relationship between you as an entity and then the other autonomous units and things that you want to organize. Like, mm-hmm. How does it work? You don't obviously feel the need to control anything when it's created eventually, but have you come up around tensions around that, about things being...
So not even. In our RLF board that we created, right, like we have a number of relatively well-qualified individuals on that board, right? Like they are prime for what, like, any sort, like, the USDA would be looking for, like, something to offer a grant to, right? Like, they have a whole host, decades of experience in finance, in lending, in banking, in all of that, right? In economics, in economic development, even. And, like, what we are doing, ways that we're building in the sort of transference of power, right? We're not allowing anything to become co-opted is that, like, we have an understudy board for the RLF where, like, there is a skills transfer and we're prioritizing Black, economically disaffected, queer, or women individuals to, like, sit on the understudy board and, like, all of the skills necessary to run that entity that has about $26,000 in it right now in order to start and develop as an economic generator worker-owned cooperatives in the town. Like, they'll be transferred those skills. So, like, even though we build something, we're building it anarchistically, or we're building it in a way where, like, it can only be used for a certain function within this, and then we set it and forget it, right? And there's also a lot of political education that goes into this.
So what Claire is talking about is our revolving loan fund that is restricted to worker-owned cooperatives only. What we're finding in America is this, like, small business succession crisis where income inequality nationwide does not allow the current generation to purchase, like, established businesses from people who are trying to retire or move or who are dying. So when we're looking, this goes back to this idea of pick up any stick, pick up any stone. When we're looking on, like, how to fund this effort, we went to, like, the USDA and a very common financial tool called a revolving loan fund. In order to meet those requirements, our board is made up of four white dudes and a white woman, right? In order to meet those requirements, not a surprise. But as you were saying, we built in this, like, understudy board that within 1 to 2 years, it'll be completely, like, rad controlled with queer people, women, and people of color. Perfectly normalized under, like, the current system. So we found a way for the federal government to, like, fund the revolution, basically. Don't tell anybody.
Or tell everyone.
All right, guys, I've got to go.
All right, cool.
Live.